This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Behavioral Health Coordinating Council advisor Tricia Malott says McLean County needs to figure out who its frequent flyers are in mental health services.
Who are intersecting with some of our highest cost services and our highest need services. And taking those individuals and that burden and that care coming from the county so that our other service providers in the community can then have the capacity to take on more individuals with lesser needs.
Mary Cullen interviews Tricia Malott about the new triage center and other service startups. Plus, Eric Stock talks with an NBA player from Bloomington Normal who is stumping for more medical devices in public places. And Ryan Denham gives us more of that, please. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. McLean County's Behavioral Health Coordinating Council is pushing forward on its mental health action plan. The board has approved an adolescent intensive outpatient services program at its June quarterly meeting. BHCC advisor Tricia Malott tells GLT's Mary Cullen about how the new outpatient program will fill a need in McLean County and provides updates on the council's other mental health projects.
The purpose is really to help meet the needs of our adolescents who are experiencing behavioral health concerns as they are either being at risk of hospitalization or coming out of hospitalization, and helping them transition back into their schools, community, and families, and to help really boost up the services that they receive in a difficult time to help better transition them.
You were speaking in the meeting about how schools don't really have the resources available. Families might not know what the next step is. So how is this going to change that?
As the name implies, it provides an intensive outpatient service. And so the exact model is not yet known, since we will issue an RFP. But our group has come together to identify what the core components of that look like. And it includes a period of time with both group modalities for treatment, as well as individual therapy, linkage with community resources, a transition back to the school, as well as family work. So that everyone is involved and that the youth get the help that they need.
Now, funding-wise, how is this program being funded? Do we know how much it's going to cost?
We have looked at some estimates of cost, but again, the exact cost isn't going to be known until any one entity or multiple entities submit their application, because how they choose to put the program in place is going to modify the cost. The funding, we are hoping to have a collaborative funding model. And that's why we've started to have discussions with different funders in our community to try to come together to pool resources. But the county will be one of those contributors.
Another program that has been in the works for a while now is the Triage Center. We've been hearing about it. It seems like things are kind of, boots are on the ground. People have been hired. I believe training starts soon. Can you kind of catch us up to date as to what's next and what that timeline looks like?
So part of what's coming is that our supervisor will continue to work on all of the implementation pieces that need to come between now and staff arriving for training and then opening the doors to individuals. And in that time, she will be working with public communication and making sure that all of our community partners understand how we are a supplement to existing services and another piece of the puzzle, rather than taking away from or changing the landscape. We're looking to supplement, and so part of what she'll be doing is that communication, but also really making sure our community knows that it will be a resource and that they will have that as an option.
And as a reminder, the Triage Center does what exactly?
The Triage Center serves as an immediate assessment and linkage to other community providers and resources when an individual is experiencing a behavioral health crisis, when it's not life-threatening. So when it's life-threatening, we would still recommend the hospital as the best placement for them.
The Triage Center does not provide psychiatric help. That's something that the county is actually looking into expanding their telepsychiatry. Can you talk about where we are in that process? I know the county is seeking out a telepsychiatrist at this time.
So we continue to work with the vendor that was approved by the county board back in December, and we have maintained that we really want the best psychiatrist to be provided for our community. And so we continue to have ongoing discussions about who that individual may be and what their prior experience and expertise is. And I was just contacted yesterday about a potential option. And so I need to review their CV and their bio to see what I think of how they may fit with McLean County's needs.
And for listeners, this is all filling up different entities to try and make a collaborative effort to address the mental health need in McLean County. So there are many different parts. One of those other parts is the FUSE program. Can you update us on what's going on with FUSE?
So our FUSE program manager was hired back in March, and in that time, she has been working on, one, her training plan for her staff, and we are working toward full implementation of her team with our community partners to get that in place. But in the interim, she has also begun doing outreach to the individuals that we know are interacting and intersecting with multiple systems of care in our community. So she's beginning to have those dialogue.
Can you explain how the trickle-down effect is? If those with the most need are being helped in some areas, what that does for our other service providers?
Absolutely. So as a reminder, FUSE is Frequent Utilizer System Engagement, and it's really looking at our individuals who are intersecting with some of our highest cost services and our highest need services, and taking those individuals and that burden and that care coming from the county so that our other service providers in the community can then have the capacity to take on more individuals with lesser needs. And then with the county taking the lead on that particular program and bearing that cost, any revenue or reimbursement that we receive, we then have the option, with the program being sustainable, to then be able to hopefully reinvest that back into other services. And so the intent is to continue to build on services within our community and meet that need, rather than just only fund a handful at any one time.
So the Behavioral Health Coordinating Council is focused on collaboration. United Way was mentioned as a new collaborative partner, and also it was discussed earlier this year, the NYU Law Enforcement Screening Tool. I know the screening tool is used by law enforcement to try and understand what are the behavioral health needs for someone who they come encounter with. Can you explain how that tool is potentially going to be introduced into this community?
Well, at this point, we are just a testing site. And so some of the specifics of how it will be implemented as a testing site are not the same as they will be when the tool is publicly available. And when the tool is publicly available, it will be accessible to law enforcement on a mobile device, be it an iPad, a phone, or an iPod, so that it's something that they can have with them potentially in their pocket, but as they encounter an individual with behavioral health concerns or that they think may, there are a series of questions and observations that they can use with the tool, which ultimately will then help them determine one of the best options for that person, be it entry into the justice system or the hospital. But in communities like ours that will have a diversion option, then they can divert that person from the justice system to also link them to treatment when that's their need. And also, the more times we keep individuals out of the justice system, then the less likely anyone is to have recidivism.
And how was McLean County selected as this testing site?
We have been having ongoing conversations with the lead researcher at NYU for over a year and staying connected with where they're at in the development of the tool and the testing. And as they had rolled out the first round of testing in Indianapolis and Marion County, Indiana, we also reached out to see if there was a way for us to potentially be a site in their second phase. And they have been great to work with so far.
GLT's Mary Cullen speaking with Tricia Millott, advisor on the Behavioral Health Coordinating Council in McLean County.
Support for WGLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, celebrating extraordinary local residents who give back to our community. Submit your nomination for the Philanthropists of the Year Award through July 31st. Nomination forms available at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, more of that, please, from Ryan Denham. Youth basketball players in McLean County got a few lessons about the game from an NBA professional over the weekend, but the real lesson U-High alum Kata Bates Diop wanted children and families to take away from the basketball camp is the need for more defibrillators at more schools and other public places. An AED saved his brother Kai's life 2 years ago. Bates Diop tells GLT's Eric Stock that helping put on the basketball clinic is his way of giving back.
No, it's not often that someone from Central Illinois makes it to the NBA is able to put on a camp for something like this just for the kids. That's all I want for them, just have a good time.
Your family has become big advocates for defibrillators, and this is the fundraiser for this for the Illinois Heart and Lung Foundation. You become big advocates since your brother went down with sudden cardiac arrest in the basketball court, and in this instance, thankfully, two trainers at the school knew where the defibrillators were and knew how to use them, and it saved him. What could be done, do you feel, to improve the likelihood of that happening in the future, where there will be someone there, have access to a defibrillator, and be able to save someone in that circumstance?
I mean, just having the funding or the money for it. Some schools obviously have more money than others, so they're able to have more things like that in general on their school. Some schools do not have that luxury, so just raising money, raising awareness for the schools, like, can't do it for themselves.
Now in the NBA, I imagine it's quite different there as a professional athlete. You have professional medical staff at the ready pretty much at all times. Is that something that you think about at all?
I'm trying to think about it. It obviously crosses my mind here and there, but, you know, I mean, this NBA season is so long and there's so many games. You travel so much, you almost have to, someone has to be aware of something like that at all times.
What's the relationship like with your brother, and how did that incident that he went through change that?
I've always been close with him, but I guess that kind of brought everybody closer together in our families. You know, stuff like that always brings people closer together. So we're pretty close now, but when we don't talk about it like we used to, like when it first happened, we just kind of like take it as a life experience, and he's grown from it, and, you know, into the man of the man he is becoming.
So you were at Ohio State when this happened, right?
Yeah, I was at school. We had just gotten practice. I just got home. My mom called me, and then I got on like the next flight out, like back here.
So how tough has it been for him to not be able to play basketball anymore, and for you to have to sort of help him through that?
It was hard really early. He was so young. I think he was 16. He was gaining, you know, college attention. He was playing Division One, but at this point, it's like, he's okay with it. You know, it's, like I said, it's just a life experience. You know, eventually, I'm gonna stop having to play the game of basketball. It's gonna be an adjustment for me, but it was obviously just earlier than mine. He's really mature with it. You know, he understands that. That's just the basketball, it's just a game he loves, and there's more to life than it.
And Kai, we understand, who is putting on this clinic this weekend, is going to Butler. He's going to be studying psychology and political science, and he wants to be a sports psychologist in the future, a job that maybe didn't really exist 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, no, it did. I took a couple classes actually in school, you know, around that same thing. They said the exact same thing, and it's kind of a relatively new field, but with all the mental health stuff going on, a lot of the leagues, NFL with the, what is it called?
Concussion, CTE.
Yeah, concussion stuff, a couple basketball players have come out and had mental issues, so it's a growing field, and I think it's important that a lot of people, not just people that play the sport, just are aware of it.
Is that something that's talked about in locker rooms that maybe wasn't 10, 20 years ago, from your experience?
In my experience, we do have a psychologist, not on staff, but available for us through some network that you can call whenever. But I think I had the same thing at Ohio State. There was always multiple sports psychologists on staff. We had so many athletes, you had to have multiple. So I think it's definitely a growing field, and it's definitely ready and available for, at least in my experience.
You talked about there will be a day where you won't be playing basketball anymore. Is that something that you might explore later?
I probably won't, just because I have other things I want to do. But that's him. That's his path he wants to follow. I've always been interested in it. I'm going to always keep an eye on it and read up on it and try and be as aware as I can about it.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Kata Bates Diop, a U-High alum and former Big Ten Player of the Year at Ohio State after your first season in the NBA with the Minnesota Timberwolves. You were, of course, a standout here back at U-High a few years ago. When did you start to think that a future in the NBA was a possibility for you?
I'd say later in my high school career, you know, the way the NBA was going, the size and build in my game kind of it's kind of built for the NBA right now, but I was trying to focus on just, you know, graduating, getting to college at that time. So it became like a full real reality thing when I got to college.
What was the reality check for you when you got to the NBA? What was it like? What maybe took you by surprise, or did it not take you by surprise that much, the transition to the pro game?
There were a lot of things that took me by surprise. The biggest thing probably is honestly the traveling. Basketball is still basketball. You know, the game doesn't change at all besides like the three-point line and stuff like that, but it's still basketball. Just knowing how to play the game, but the traveling, you know, it's 82 games. We're traveling all year round, all over the country, and there's no way to prepare for that. You know, leaving at midnight, landing somewhere at 3 in the morning, having to play that next day, or, you know, back-to-back and stuff like that. Yeah, there's no way to prepare for it.
It's a grind, right?
It's a grind. It's extremely – the season just ended, you know, 2 days ago for two teams. So we've been going since, I think, August or September. So it's like 8-9 months for teams that advance in the playoffs.
It does seem like the game has changed quite a bit since you were in high school, not that long ago, with the game being – it seems, from a fan standpoint, faster paced, higher scoring, more emphasis on the three-point shot. Analytics seems to suggest that more three-point shots give you a better chance to win. And it's become more of a smaller man's game. As someone who is 6'9", how have you had to adapt your game, or have you had to make that adjustment at all as you made the transition from high school to college to the pros?
Yeah, definitely. It's been an adjustment probably since I got to college. I think a lot of colleges are trying to emulate the NBA at this point, so we play a lot of small ball at school. I played with 4, 5 sometimes in college, and 3, 4, 5 sometimes in college. Well, at the NBA, it was the same kind of thing. I played with 3 or 4, or went back and forth with the G League and the NBA. I played the 5, so you know, everybody's trying to make an adjustment. It's not like there are very few teams that start, you know, an extremely big lineup. Most of the teams, you know, like Warriors, for example, I mean, Draymond Green's at 4, and he's shorter than me. He plays the 4, but he's obviously great in his role, but that's a lot of teams nowadays. They play really, really small. They like to switch everything and shoot a lot of threes.
But as you mentioned, the offseason really just began a couple of days ago, and it almost seems, from a fan standpoint anyway, that the offseason is just as important as the regular season because of free agency, players coming and going. Kevin Durant is the big prize of the free agent market this year, and it seems to have like a domino effect across the league. Is that something that as a player you pay attention to, knowing that just the way things shift, players come and go and end up in other teams?
Yeah, that's just the business of it. You know, I got that firsthand this year. We had a trade that went on, you know, in my first year. So after that, they just said a lot of the coaches, just the vets, just said that's just the business of it. You know, even during the season, off season, there's going to be trades, players sign different places, coaches, coaching changes, front office changes. That's just the way it is. It's not like college, or you might have the same coaching staff or same team essentially for 2, 3, 4 years. There's a lot of turnover in the NBA, and that's just the business of it.
One other issue I wanted to touch on that the NBA has had to confront this year is fan access. There was an investor with the Golden State Warriors, was banned for a year after shoving a player during an NBA Finals game. Another veteran player, Kyle Korver, a Missouri Valley alum, wrote about the sometimes difficult interactions the players have with fans who are so close to the action. Sometimes it's the home fans too. Now, he's white, but he says sometimes there's a tinge of racism to it from fans. Have you had any encounters like that? Is that something the players have talked about at all?
You know, I haven't had any encounters like that, but obviously I have had multiple encounters like that just this past year. But you know, that's what also makes our game, I think, the best in the world, is that our fans are right there. You know, in football, there's a big space between it. Hockey, there's an actual wall. In baseball, there's a net and further back. So that comes with just the responsibility of being down there and knowing how to conduct yourself.
You like the proximity, the intimacy with the fans.
Yeah, definitely. I enjoy it. You know, there's always those few instances that make it look bad, but that's not all fans. Everybody knows that. Most of the time, nothing happens during the game. So, you know, I think that's what makes it the best. The fans are right there.
With that, Kate, Bates Diop, a UHI alum, Ohio State alum, second year with the Minnesota Timberwolves coming up. What's next for you? What are you looking to do to take that next step in the NBA?
Just improve on all aspects. You know, you said the offseason probably just important or more important than the regular season, just in terms of the work you put in. You know, the best players, all the young guys, just working hard all year to improve, you know, all facets of the game.
When you come back to town, I imagine probably not very often. What do you like to do when you're back with the family? Any places that you want to visit or need to go back and see?
Yeah, when I'm home, like you said, I'm not here super long, never more than probably 3 or 4 days. So when I'm here, I kind of like to relax. These are usually my days off. I maybe do something 1 or 2 other days, but you know, hang out with my family. I get to see them often. You know, all of us together. See my best friends that grow up that are still here, eat at some of the spots, you know, just kind of enjoy, you know, being back home.
So this might be an annual thing, this clinic here?
Yeah, I'm hoping for it. I'm hoping to do this, you know, every year. Probably not a different batch of kids, but as the kids get older, you know, try and get the new kids going up.
Maybe that will foretell a career in coaching for you at some point, right?
No, coaching for me. That's more like my brother. That'd be more my brother's speed than me. I'm more of a like behind the scenes stuff, like, you know, managing, setting all this kind of stuff up. I don't like to, you know, run it specifically.
That's UHI alum and NBA player Kata Bates Diop with GLT's Eric Stock. The First Time Clinic was a fundraiser for the Illinois Heart and Lung Association so it can buy more defibrillators to donate to those who need them.
My name is Christopher Gallwitzer. I own and operate Night Shop in downtown Bloomington.
And Night Shop is a new GLT underwriter.
We're reaching people who are looking outside of the box for music, people that are educated and know something about conscious eating. GLT is an accessible station with strong followers and open-minded followers. To me, it's kind of a no-brainer.
Learn more about partnering with GLT at wglt.org/corporate-support.
GLT is a service of Illinois State University. Illinois State provides accessible opportunity and increasingly reflects the nation's diversity and changing demographics. Nearly one quarter of Illinois State student population comes from underrepresented groups. More at illinoisstate.edu/points of pride. This is 89.1 GLT and wglt.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up in just a few minutes on 89.1 and WGLT.org, the president of Western Illinois University is out. We'll hear more from IPR reporter Rich Egger. If you've been listening to GLT's The Leadoff podcast, you've been hearing a new series we're calling More of That, Please. Every week or so, we're introducing you to a new community servant who's making Bloomington Normal a better place. Today, GLT's Ryan Denham introduces you to Sarah Tunnel, who's bringing youth outreach programs to where they're needed most.
Like many of us living in Bloomington Normal, Tunnel is a transplant. She grew up in Oregon and has only been here about 5 years. But in those 5 years, she's done more for Bloomington Normal than many townies have done in their whole lifetime here. Let me give you some examples. Sarah is the director of youth development at the Bloomington Normal YMCA. This summer, she's doing two new things. First is a summer day camp just for kids from Woodhill Towers Public Housing and the Home Sweet Home Shelter. For $5, they get all the experiences of a much more expensive summer camp, like swimming, games, and time with other kids.
I grew up going to a day camp in a sense. I grew up going to overnight camp from the time I was in third grade, and it was formative in who I am. It is extremely formative in how a kid handles relationships and how they handle conflict and how they learn about themselves and who they are. And so I know that kids from lower income families and kids who are experiencing homelessness don't have those same opportunities. And we are literally across the street from public housing. We are literally across the street from Home Sweet Home. And so we have the resources, we have the people, we have the opportunity to provide that experience for kids to really just start to taste something different than what they've ever tasted before.
And the counselors leading that 3-day camp will be special too. They'll be the YMCA's lead campers, a new program Sarah is spearheading for high schoolers who want to one day work with kids but need a little bit of mentorship first.
How to lead games and how to do public speaking, and we're going to do a couple college visits and just an opportunity for them to grow as individuals, to get to play some this summer, and to have an opportunity that looks really good on their resume too for the future.
Creating youth outreach programs is kind of Sarah's thing. A couple years ago, she led the creation of the Northwest Neighborhood Community Center in West Bloomington. She said that experience taught her a lot about her new hometown.
People have a desire to serve and help others, whether that's their neighbor, whether that's East Side, West Side, whether that's normal Bloomington. People get excited about a cause. And so it's been fun to watch, and that's what I really learned as I was working at NNCC and even here at the Y. Like, all you got to do is share a story, and people in Bloomington are all about being part of that story and all about being part of what is happening in a community. And that's a really unique and cool thing.
She can create all the youth programs she likes. She still needs kids to show up. That's gotten really hard. Her biggest competitor is Fortnite. But those online connections aren't as real as the ones you make in person. Sarah herself knows what can happen when an adult invests in a kid, and her kids need it.
I think often we look at kids who come from West Bloomington, and we're like, oh, they're trouble, or oh, they're poor, or oh, you know, because of whatever background they're from, they're different from me. And I think the reality is I want people to know that kids have a future and kids have a hope, and we get to be part of that. No matter where they come from, no matter what their economic status is, no matter their color of their skin, their religion, anything. Like, every kid brings something to the table. A kindergartner brings something to the table. And so, you know, it's how do we as adults learn from them and grow from them.
That's Sarah Tennell, the transplant who's making her new hometown a better place. Let's have more of that, please.
I'm Ryan Denham.
This story was featured on GLT's The Leadoff. Subscribe to our newest podcast at WGLT.org/leadoff. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a new book by an ISU faculty member looks at a bureaucratic history of Nazi Germany. Western Illinois University President Jack Thomas will step down on June 30th, but he'll continue to collect a paycheck from the university beyond that date. IPR's Rich Egger has more.
The agreement between Dr. Thomas and Western's Board of Trustees calls for Thomas to receive his current pay of $270,000 each of the next 2 years. Thomas brought the proposal to the board during a closed-door meeting Thursday night. The board approved it unanimously the following morning. Board Chairperson Greg Aguilar feels the deal was in the best interest of the university and Thomas.
It was a challenging time to be a president at Western Illinois University with the budget cuts, with the declining enrollment, and then the challenges that we experienced with the community. And I feel that President Thomas thought it would be best to start a clean slate to drive the Western Illinois University into the next 100 years. And President Thomas is just one of those leaders who is incredible at navigating challenging times, and he went through a lot of challenging times, and with that often comes a lot of, I guess we'll say, damage to a person when it comes to making tough decisions. And so with so many tough decisions having been made and people expressing how they felt about those decisions, President Thomas thought it was best for the university and himself to step down.
So he will be on paid administrative leave for 2 years, full salary?
So it's 1 year leave and then 1 year sabbatical.
Full salary for both of those?
Yes.
Okay. Why was the board agreeable to that much of a payout that's more than $500,000?
Well, it was what the president was making. And my thought is, after the conversation yesterday with the board and President Thomas, because of the hard work that he has put in and what he has done for this university, we thought it was fair. And that way we could accept his resignation, and then we could move on from there.
There are many Western employees who have lost their jobs in the past year or so who have not gotten any type of severance package. What would you tell them?
I would tell them that the decisions that we had to make were difficult. It wasn't anything that we wanted to do. And if we can start seeing an increase in enrollment, and if we had that enrollment, we wouldn't have to make those decisions. And it is our hope that we can increase that enrollment and see what the future brings, especially those who unfortunately had to be laid off.
I know you've only been on the board a couple months, but as you look over Dr. Thomas's career as the president, is there anything in particular that stands out for you?
President Thomas has always been student-oriented. He cares so much about the students and their success, and I've never met a person like him. I also am extremely impressed with his integrity and his resilience. He has had to deal with so many things that were out of his control. He has had to face a community that was extremely challenging to him and with the university in some of its most vulnerable times. And he held his head high, he acted with courage, and he always made the best decision he could with the situation and never forgetting how his decisions would affect the students and the university. And I just have great admiration for him, and I surely will miss him, but I understand why he chose to do what he did.
Do you feel there were racial overtones to the recent calls for him to leave?
Absolutely. When you look at some of the questions that he has been asked, or some of the things he has been blamed for, other presidents of other universities don't have to endure some of those same questions. When you look at public institutions and those who are majority white, there are only 8 of all the presidents, only 8% of them are African American. There are systems in place that we have to address and look at that aren't equitable. There are unequitable systems that keep women out, people of color out, people of certain ages out, and we have to be aware of this. And I think Western is one of those universities that's going to be leading this dialogue and conversation. And I also think that it's time we start looking at how do we start racial healing within the community and within the university.
What will you personally be looking for in the next president of Western Illinois University?
Someone who can bring people together. Someone who can create a strong vision of where we are going to be a year from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now. I'm looking for someone who can really help advance our enrollment and our marketing and communications so that we can better share our story with not only the United States, not only the state of Illinois, but the entire world. You know, we are living in a diverse and changing world, and I would love to see that our next president helps guide that so we can win and attract the next generation of students.
Greg Aguilar is chairperson of the Western Illinois University Board of Trustees. He says the board will conduct a national search for the university's next president. No timeline has been set for hiring someone. Current president Jack Thomas will retire at the end of the month. Rich Egger reporting.
You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's only locally owned and operated broadcast media outlet. Let's take you behind the scenes in the horrible Nazi bureaucracy. Katrine Paler is an ISU history professor who has published a book on the Third Reich's intelligence services, in particular the career of a man named Walter Schellenberg, the head of the Foreign Intelligence Service, or Department 6. Paler says she was interested in Nazi intellectuals, a whole group of young men who entered the SS, Himmler's secret police, and entered the security service. Paler says she was interested in them because they were different from the run-of-the-mill Nazis who went into the party early and rose through the ranks.
Different about them is their education. So we're talking about university-educated people here to quite some extent. That is very different from many other high Nazi officials. So that makes them unusual. What also makes them unusual is the way they sell their commitment, the way they talk about their commitment or don't talk about their commitment to Nazi Germany. So the way how they portray themselves at the time and then after the war as well. So that's where I would locate the main difference.
Are they common as a class about the shifting ground? It's initially portraying themselves as true believers and then fighting their bureaucratic battles, and then after the war saying, oh, it was something else. I just had to do it because that was how you had to act in my country.
Let's just say they're common enough. They're common enough, but they also, these are not the men that after the war define the image of Nazi Germany. What defines the image is the brown shirt, the SA person. What defines the image is the, to some extent, crazy, or what seems to be very crazy from the outside. So it's not these particular men who define the image. And that was, to some extent, what drew me to that, this particular group of people which assembles, gathers in the SD, and becomes quite important there.
So talk about Schellenberg. He started out as a medical student and then switched to law and joined the Nazi Party in 1933 and very quickly became a rising star. What made him that rising star and similar to this class of young intellectuals that you're looking at?
Well, he claimed to be a medical student. Actually, I haven't found that in the records. So what I can tell from the records is that he was always a student of law.
Why claim that?
Because it made for a good story after the war. That so Schellenberg survives the war. He is put on trial in the subsequent trials at Nuremberg, gets a few years in prison, gets out early, writes an autobiography, which is an autobiography very much written for the West German post-war public and for the Anglophone public. So here he is telling a story of a young man who had this humanist leaning of sorts, wanted to be a medical student, but decided to study law because it was the more prudent decision, financially more prudent decision. And I just find it interesting. It's a throwaway line in his autobiography, and it shows up in lots and lots of books on where he is mentioned. It's a small thing, but I went into his records, student records, and there's no indication that he ever studied medicine.
Small details matter in crafting a legend. What other kinds of things popped out at you when you took a detailed look at his life that were false or served to shape his narrative?
The way how he talks about his family or doesn't talk about his family or what he then decides to share about the family. So he very much crafts his narrative before 1933 of that, of a young man who is comes from a family that was battered very hard by the end of World War One and the reparations. So he's feeding into this whole myth.
But you're making the point that he paid his tuition on time and he was pretty stable in his finances.
Yes, he was. I mean, I can't tell where his money is coming from, but he's always paying his tuition on time. So you can see from the matriculation box where he signs up and they basically put in a check mark if you pay. And he pays in full each and every time. And there's also this really intriguing decision for him to go to this particular university where he's going at that point in time. So that is the first career move he's making.
It's a quality university in Marburg.
It's a quality university. It's also a university which is at that point known for radical right-wing politics among the students.
So he's already tacking.
Yes, he's not involved with the Nazis at that point, but he also gets himself involved with a very prestigious fraternity. So, you know, you can see the social climber there, the social political climber very early on, and I find it quite fascinating. And not that religion is the most important point for all. I know he never was particularly religious, but he came from a Catholic background. Marburg is the oldest Protestant university in all of Germany. Very proudly so. It doesn't mean that you can't be Catholic to go to that university, but there is a statement in there. For a person of that background from that part of the country going to this university at that point in time.
It's a cultural statement.
It's also a political statement, mm-hmm. I would argue.
Okay.
More so than a cultural statement.
So is he common? Is he a type of striver here who fashions themselves and creates almost a con?
I wouldn't quite call it a con, but I would argue that he's very much part and parcel of this group of youngish men who try very hard to make their way.
So in a lot of bureaucratic apparatuses, and the intelligence services of Nazi Germany are a bureaucratic apparatus, full of infighting, as you make clear here, full of navel gazing, in addition to looking outside, according to their mission statements, in a lot of cultures like that, you're not going to get such a concentration of strivers, of myth makers about themselves. You're going to get some people like that, but you're going to also have
careerists. You're also going to have people who believe in mission. You're looking at this class and saying these rose to the top almost uniformly. What about Nazi Germany made these folks' ascension more prevalent than in other places, perhaps?
Nazism was, to quite some extent, a youth movement. So it was a really good place for young and ambitious men to make careers real fast. Everybody was young. So that, I think, is a very important point we tend to lose sight of, how ridiculously young everyone was. And it was also a world in which the world was created anew. So radical ideas could find more than a hearing, could find support. The eminent British historian Ian Kusher talks about working towards a Führer. So working towards a leader, anticipating what the leader wants. If you're good at that, you can make a career in Nazi Germany. And if you are able to navigate this difficult, somewhat difficult in-between time, the move from a bureaucracy that originated in the Weimar Republic into the new bureaucracy, if you can navigate that and talk about that smartly and are both ideological and pragmatic, you're basically golden.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with ISU history professor Katrin Paehler about her book, The Third Reich's Intelligence Services, The Career of Walter Schellenberg. One of the ways in which he worked toward the Führer was to hitch himself to Himmler. How did that work?
Schellenberg is really good at finding patrons all through his career. So he makes this very rapid rise, even for Nazi standards, through the SD by basically finding himself always a patron who is one or two steps ahead of himself and proving himself to that person. And the most important here before Himmler, and I'll get to him in a moment, is actually Heydrich, Reinhard Heydrich. And Heydrich finds himself in a bit of a predicament in 37, 38, 39. And it's trying to figure out how this new bureaucracy of Nazi Germany is going to look. So the question becomes, are the new bureaucrats of the state-to-be, are they going to be political soldiers, meaning ideologues, or are they going to be, let's put it like this, traditionally trained bureaucrats? And it has to do, obviously, with a bureaucracy, but for the men who are in the middle of this, it also has to do with state positions, state pensions, what qualifications does one need to do what. So Schellenberg, to quite some extent, is the political soldier, the ideologue. But Schellenberg, having studied law, he can also make the law argument. So he is the man in between, who decides to throw in his lot very early on with Heydrich, because he seems to be very good at reading the environment, reading the room, and Heydrich is the coming man.
Apart from that, you also have your external mission. It's a foreign intelligence service that he's starting to head. Did he deliver?
No. Next question.
Okay.
It was an epic failure as an intelligence service. What makes this particular intelligence service so interesting is that it's a completely new outfit within the SD. It's sometimes called Amt Ausland, sometimes Office 6, depending on what year you are in. And they envision this as a political foreign intelligence service, and political here very much means that everybody comes out of the Nazi worldview. There was no shortage of intelligence services in Germany. So there's a traditional Abwehr, the military intelligence service, and much of what Office 6, Amt 6 wanted to do was to collect political intelligence, and that to quite some extent was done by the diplomatic services. So it was a crowded field, to say the least. The claim to fame was that they are more ideological, that they are more Nazified, that they know how to do it right. They knew how to interpret the world in the proper sense.
Is this a cautionary tale about allowing ideology to shape your product and make it ineffective?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the epitome of a cautionary tale when it comes to, well, screwing up intelligence collection.
Give a couple examples, would you?
Say, for example, they're looking at Hungary. And every problem they see with a German ally of Hungary is focused on the Jewish influence in Hungary that still exists, according to the SD, in 1940. So they are also then making policy prescriptions in a way that might please Hitler. The same, you see it mostly in the reporting, the same way they look at the United States. And at a certain point, there's a list going around of people in the United States and politicians who might support Nazi Germany. And basically, it is a wish list. A wish list also in the sense that everybody who isn't for Roosevelt is going to be for Hitler.
It does not follow.
Yes, it does not follow, but there's very much this ideological thinking here.
He tended his myth even after he got out of prison, and he got a very light prison sentence, as you make the point. How did he do that?
He got this very light prison sentence because he managed to portray himself as a humanist and what I call a thwarted bringer of peace. Because in the last month of the war, Schellenberg was actually engaged in, I'm trying to find the words carefully here, engaged in peace soundings with Western allies.
Is that legitimate, or is that him reading the political winds and deciding, I'm going to become a refugee and position myself here?
I think it's all of the above.
Oh, okay.
So it's all of the above in the sense of, had he been the man to deliver a negotiated peace with the Western allies, he would have been golden. At the same time, the negotiations allow himself to position himself for a post-war situation, let's put it broadly like that.
Coming trials.
Coming, whatever is coming in the future, and I don't think he's necessarily expecting a trial. I think he is to quite some extent expecting that, he would find a job with British or U.S. intelligence rather quickly, because part and parcel of those peace soundings is Schellenberg's willingness to trade Jewish concentration camp inmates for negotiations. So that is where he is trying to put on the veneer of humanism.
So he used Jews on the way up to establish his reputation and help organize the Einsatzgruppen of the roving death squads, and he's using it on the way down to cushion his fall.
Yes, absolutely.
That's abhorrent.
Yes. Absolutely.
And he gets away with it.
And he gets away with it.
Did a lot of them get away with it? A lot of people of his class, these young intellectuals?
Quite a few of them, yes. I mean, especially those who hadn't actively massacred people. I mean, even of those, plenty get away with it. But Schellenberg is kind of in this woolly, rather sweet spot, where he had been involved with racist policies, with the Holocaust, enough to help him with his career early on, but not enough that he became a hands-on murderer. And that makes the difference here. He's the person organizing in the background, making sure that negotiations work out. I mean, famously, the negotiations in early 41 about the deployment of the Einsatzgruppen, which are those mobile killing squads, and there is a big to-do between the SS and the military about how is this going to work, who is going to do what, and so on and so forth. And Schellenberg, by his own account, this is actually quite interesting, claims to have solved the issue. Intriguingly enough, I can't quite find it in the documents. I mean, in the contemporaneous documents, but he insists on it. So this is one of the instances where I actually take him by his word.
He's claiming a win.
If you're claiming a win here, I'm going to think you are not lying on that, because any reasonable person would want to lie about that, I think.
What's your takeaway about Schellenberg and about this class of young Nazi strivers? What did you come away with after this deep look?
Disgust. I mean, I spent entirely too much time on this, and it's a deep disgust and dislike. But I had that before, so not much of a change here. To some extent, I'm more interested in how the system functions. Because there's this huge debate, which has been going on about Nazi Germany forever, to quite some extent. You know, how important is pragmatism? How important is ideology? And trying to think about that and trying to, you know, sort that out as carefully as possible, that's what I found quite intriguing here.
Katrine Paler is the author of The Third Reich's Intelligence Services, The Career of Walter Schellenberg, out from Cambridge University Press. She is a professor at Illinois State University. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. WGLT.org is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews with help today from Eric Stock, Mary Cullen, and Ryan Denham. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.